and welcome to Dynasty As They Want to Be, a podcast where we drill into every episode of the iconic 1980s television series Dynasty. I'm your host, Derek J. Lang, and with me is my co-host, Kyler K. Jafari.
Bonjour, party people.
Hola. Well, I guess we should apologize for being absentee for a while. You know, there's been a lot going on in the world.
We took a mid-season hiatus.
Yeah, just a little hiatus. You know, there's so much going on. We just felt like we didn't want to be in the mix. You know, like, I understand this podcast is fun and everything, but there are more important things for people to be consuming the past few weeks.
I think we've covered this topic before. Where is Dynasty tacky right now, given what's going on, or is it escapism and therefore justifies itself?
I mean, even if it is escapism, I think there's more important things going on that we shouldn't necessarily be escaping right now when it comes to consuming culture and media. So yeah, that was kind of the reason for the mid-season hiatus, but now we're back.
So we have, in honor of the mystic psychic powers in this current episode.
Yes, a return to the supernatural of Dynasty.
I think our prior visit to that realm was what, the over-the-top tarot card reader / psychic in Rome.
Yeah, for psychic stuff. But I mean, we also got, you know, some optical illusions and all kinds of things in this episode.
So yeah, so we're having a drink called a High Priestess, which is kind of actually just a made-up drink. It's a variation on the margarita and the daiquiri. But when I say those two names, those are not referring to like the frozen pool drink from Panama City that apparently margaritas and daiquiris have turned into. But anyway, so yeah, it's 1.5 ounces of rum and 1 ounce of Frangelico, which is sort of like the bizarre variation ingredient. And then your classic 1/2 ounce of lime. So you've got your sweet, you've got your sour, you've got your base alcohol. I don't know if tequila would work with this, because I think the Frangelico is too jarring with tequila, so that's why it's more on the rum.
I don't think I've ever had anything like this before. I'm excited.
And then I threw in a dash of orange bitters and some herbals, which were rosemary and mint. I would have used basil if I had that, but that's what we had.
So. Oh, and these are fresh herbs grown by yours truly.
In your micro farm.
COVID-inspired herb garden.
So it's called a High Priestess because of the Frangelico. It's, you know, Pope on a rope or whatever we used to call it. It's that mystical.
I didn't even realize we had Frangelico in the bar.
Here's the thing. This isn't a drink I would recommend, but if you've had too many rum daiquiris and too many tequila margaritas, and you just happen to have the ingredients knocking about in your liquor cabinet, it's something fun to try as a diversion.
Well, cheers. Oh, yeah. It's very herbaceous.
Yeah, it's herbaceous. And then you get like sort of the nutty background from the Frangelico, which is sort of like would seem like it doesn't work with lime, but it totally does in an odd way.
Yeah, it's weird.
This is definitely one of those like you're bored with what you've been drinking and you just need to press the reset button and have something a little different.
Yeah, this isn't something that I think anybody would necessarily crave. Mm-mm.
But it's definitely invoking all those mystical powers of alcohol.
I can see Stephen Carrington right now, and I've only had 2 sips.
Yeah, yeah. You're totally getting like the doodle-doo flashes.
Yeah, you look like Fallon right now. I want to go over there and make out with
you. You're
going
to come gang rape me.
Ooh, you can't say that.
Whoops, sorry.
Well, I do have some good news. I haven't really talked about this with you, but we are available to be nominated for the Podcast Awards. Did you know this?
Yes, I knew this because you told me
earlier. Oh, I did tell you. Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to tell everybody else out there, if they're so inclined, go to podcastawards.com and you can nominate us in the People's Choice category and the TV and film category. So maybe we'll win an award and a trophy. I don't know if there's like a ceremony, probably not now. If they did have one, I think it's going to be...
It'd just be like a Zoom call or something.
Yeah, exactly. But that's fun. So we could get some more recognition for the podcast.
Well, I mean, honestly, if you're watching Dynasty, this is the only game in town if you want a podcast about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're listening, you might as well just go to podcastawards.com. Yeah.
Love us or not, we're all you got.
It doesn't cost anything. You just have to sign up with your email address. So So go do it right now. Push pause, go to podcastawards.com and scroll down, look for Dynasties They Want to Be under the D section.
You sound like the customer support hotline, like walking me through the steps to reset my password or something. Mm-hmm.
And hold down the power button.
Did you plug it in first?
Did you hit the eject button?
Feel like we're locked in our homes for 12 hours at a time, and yet I have an even shorter attention span than I ever have had. Like, sitting through an episode of Dynasty feels like watching a movie now.
Well, especially this week's episode. Oh, God, it was kind of triggering.
Gotta say, it's kind of a funky episode.
Yeah, well, let's take a break, and we'll get into this week's episode, The Search. Today's installment of Dynasty As They Want to Be is brought to you by Audible. Audible is offering our darlings a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/nastypodcast. That's NASTY podcast. Or you can text Nasty Podcast to 500-500. There, browse their unrivaled selection of audio programs. They have, it seems like, everything. I actually found a children's book about Queen Goddess Ella Fitzgerald that's narrated by Billy Dee Williams. How freaking cool is that? To get started, simply go to audibletrial.com/nastypodcast or text Nasty Podcast to 500-500. Well, we're back in Bali, where Alexis and Blake are searching for Stephen Carrington, or Stephen Carrington's body. I don't know. It's so, they leave it so up in the air whether he's actually alive or not.
It's definitely like an issue of habeas corpus. Like, without the body, they don't really know if he's dead or alive. And
well, Blake seems to think he is definitely alive, and I do not understand where his logic is coming from this whole episode, but especially with, like,
what do you mean? Have you not been watching this show since episode one? Come on. But this is what Blake does. Like, this is his personality. So I understand, like, the writer's angle here, which is he's just going to power through. This is how he built his empire. This is how he dealt with his messy family politics. But and this is now how he's dealing with his son being potentially dead.
All the signs
dead.
That the writers have planted here make it seem like he's dead, right? Everybody else on the oil rig except for one guy is
yeah, but this
dead.
Is,
the bodies have turned
okay,
up.
Okay, but again, this is soap opera writing, so it's all like information management. Like, they're feeding that to you, but then if you've watched a soap opera, you know to totally not believe what you're being presented on the
Alexis
screen.
Alexis doesn't believe that because she's ready to have a memorial service, and she's grieving. She really has reached the first stage of
yeah.
the grieving
She's two
process.
Tears in a bucket, motherfucker, because this is what she did with Adam back in the day. Like, oh, our son's gone. I guess the search is called off now. Bye-bye.
Well, I do
so
like...
Same thing with Steven here. Like, she gave it a hot minute, and she's like, okay, well, I guess he's dead, and now I'm going to go cry about it and be done.
Ice cold.
So, you know, which is in opposition to what Blake's personality
Blake
is.
Blake does mention that he gave up too quickly on Adam, and look what happened there.
Stop that crying. There's no need to cry.
No need to cry. How can you say that? Our son is dead, Blake.
He's still alive somewhere. I know it.
Do you?
Yes. I gave up once on Adam. Turned out he was alive. I'm not going to give up on Stephen.
So I guess it does kind of make sense, but I don't know. From my point, I'd just be like, I'm going home. He's dead.
Well, it's definitely one of those, like, they've exhausted all the options here. Even the pilot, the captain, who's this guy? I don't know. And he's, like, in, like, the 1970s jungle safari suit. Like,
I
what
think
is
he's
that?
One of
like,
the skippers from the Jungle Cruise.
The Jungle Cruise
at
Disney.
Disneyland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Or he's, like, going to serve me some tiki drinks in that or something. I don't know. But anyway, even he's, like, done. He's like, look, I got to move on. Like, my guy's got other projects to work on.
Yeah,
so
we got other oil rig explosions to deal with. I do have to give kudos to the production designers, though, because they did a really good job of making it seem like they were in a Borneo hospital. And the stakes, I feel like, haven't really
it's
been this high
one of those,
before.
Like, you watch stuff from this period, and it seems like outside of the United States, the rest of the world was still stuck in the 70s. Because I don't know, something about that hospital, even the captain, even though like he's not of the people, but like...
Well,
he's,
darling, it's only 1982.
I know, but
three.
Then you go back to Denver, Colorado, and everybody's all 1982'd up. Like they're looking sequins and blown out hair. And you go to, you know, Borneo and it's...
Well,
like,
hell, they went to Malibu in this episode.
Polyester
and that
double
seemed
knit
pretty
and,
70s too.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, but you definitely get like some of these like early 80s moments where it's clearly not the 70s anymore, but not here, not in Bali or Borneo. It's very much a, it's like those vacation destination postcards from the time, you know. There's like lots of fondue and poi.
You know, the color of poi kind of reminds me of that color of Jeff's office, which I still cannot
believe.
The
color
believe.
Of poison.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, we all love a shitty play on words.
What I don't like is the fact that we're still dealing with this mischievous Adam Carrington painting Jeff Colby's office plot. Although, it really does come to a head
here. The more it sinks in, just the funnier it is. It's such bad writing that it's almost like, well, yes, this is a soap opera. This is soap operatic.
Yeah. I'm fine with that. But like, this has gone on for like more than three episodes.
It definitely is
now.
One of those things that needs to wind up. And like, yeah, we need to resolve this and find something new.
Paint the wall, let it dry, and then like, let's move on. But I don't know what is in this paint, but it has very unique properties because now it's using like Star Trek teleporter technology
like,
to turn Kirby
into Fallon.
Yeah, it's
like there's like peyote or something in this paint because yeah, these are like he's having out of body experiences or something.
It's causing him to sweat. It's causing him to see his ex-wife.
Which I guess we're supposed to accept the fact that he's still holding a torch for Fallon. And that's
I know.
What this
it's
is
like
all about.
The writers are trying to make him so puritanical that he's not allowed to cheat on Fallon, even though she's done all of this stuff to him. Like, the only way he can do it is if he sniffs glue and Fallon beams in from the USS Enterprise.
If we didn't know that Fallon was a space alien by now, like, so kind of, that kind of makes sense now that you
yeah,
point
well,
that
and
out.
Foreshadowing too, right? But let me ask you this. Is it cheating if you kiss another woman?
But you thought she's your wife.
Because you've been poisoned by teal paint.
I mean, these are the big questions that this show is asking us to contemplate. The other thing that you get in Jeff's office, though, along with that hallucination, is the very real appearance of Kirby with all of her, like, okay, so Kirby is amateur hour. She is so trying to be the psychotic manipulator, but she's no good at it. And she gets in over her head later with Adam, but even here with Jeff, it's like she's trying to, you know, trick him into going to a movie with her and like, oh, maybe if he spends some time with me, he'll consummate this relationship. And everybody keeps telling her to just go see a movie. So she goes to see a movie because Jeff won't go with her. And like, instead of going to just like, you know, I don't know, what's out in November, December of 1982, she could have gone and seen Sophie's Choice or she could have gone and seen Tootsie, but instead she goes and sees some fake movie that's not real, that's basically a meta a meta on Dynasty, and like it's all just an excuse for her to talk about, you know, in thinly veiled terms, the relationship she has with Jeff.
Right.
And then Jeff's like, oh yes, I'm, you know, deprived of love. And
well, he thinks her describing the movie
is describing
Fallon.
Him and Fallon, right?
No, well, Fallon describing him in Fallon.
Well,
so that's the
yeah,
entree
that's
for him
third
to
layer.
Plant his lips yeah, on her. So. But what I thought was really interesting is that she admits that she's always loved him.
But has she already admitted that she's always loved him?
Well, you could see it when she was like walking out of the taxi, that the look on her eyes when she looked at Jeff the turtle, that she always loved him.
Well, in some ways, this is a little bit Jeff's fault for not just taking her home.
There you go. Blame the man.
No. I mean specifically because then she goes off onto a very dark misadventure.
Kirby.
Adam, would you please let go of me?
What's the matter?
Please let go of me.
Not until you tell me what's wrong.
All right. I started on this stupid diet this morning. I haven't eaten all day and I'm famished. And I always cry when I'm famished.
I knew a girl like that once. She dissolved in her own tears.
We've had this moment on this show before and we're going to have it again this episode. Great.
Yeah, trigger warning.
It's only been two seasons since we had this.
Sexual abuse ahead. I didn't see this coming. I mean, I guess that's kind of the point, but
that's again why? This episode is not good, and not because of just this specifically, but you're being asked to like take a lot of leaps of faith about a lot of the characters and events happening, and this thing with Adam essentially date raping Kirby.
He
don't mean to be casual about it. I mean, it's like it's not exciting to watch on the screen, and no, I don't know, like,
and but, it's not, you know, I understand that sexual abuse is sometimes part of narratives in film and television and literature, and it, you know, means something, but this, I don't understand.
It just kind of almost comes out of nowhere.
It seems like sensational and gross.
Yeah, it's exploiting the exploited, and I'm not like a big SJW or anything like this. I'm really saying the idea of being date raped is already an important and very unappealing topic, and then to use it as sensationalized entertainment, as you say.
Yeah, and it happens like between a commercial break.
It's totally exploitation. And she's very much like, I was saying this earlier, she's the amateur in all of this. Like, it's interesting, they're both having dinner and they're both a couple of like semi-psychotics, but he's clearly, you know, the most practiced at it, and she's just kind of like swimming in deep waters that she has no business being in. That's what I'd really dislike about the way this is presented, because it's almost... it's the classic 80s, well, she victimized herself. Like, mm-hmm. It's not...
yeah, she's more disappointed in herself.
Oh, she wore a short pink dress, and she drank too much champagne. I think she even says that. She's like, oh, I had too much champagne. You know, and it's the way that the victim is made to be, like, the perpetrator of the crime.
Well, in my point, I'm looking at it from a broader perspective. The writers didn't have to do that, you know? They could have just hooked up, like... the problem is she does not offer consent multiple times. She says no. No, no, no. She doesn't want to kiss him. Certainly doesn't want to have sex with him. But the writers could have made it, you know, maybe, you know, we've all like done some things that we're not super proud of, but it wasn't sexual abuse. So maybe this could have been a situation where they hooked up and then she didn't feel so great about it, but not that she was violated, as she clearly was in this episode. So the whole thing just leaves me icky, because it doesn't do anything but make the people telling the story look bad, because we already know Adam's a sleazeball.
And well, my thing is,
we already know Kirby's
this episode's already been, or sorry, this season has already been so good, and the prior season was so good. It wasn't like they needed to like pull out the emergency rape scene to like get the ratings back up. So this just all just sort of seems, there's just no justification. I don't understand. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe this was just more casual back then. I can't imagine what the audience would have thought of this at the time. So maybe that's all it is. But well, I don't know, to I watch definitely it today, it's not a, not.
I definitely think, I mean, I haven't done scholarship into this, but I think stuff like this is the reason why it's so hard for survivors to come forward, because this is what you're watching on one of the most popular shows on TV. You know, think about it. If you were somebody who went through something like this, and this is how it's depicted, where it's your fault because you drank too much champagne and you just wanted to dance, like, no, gross. Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, all of this is like kind of underscoring how I used to not like Kirby's character, but now I just feel super bad for her.
I mean, I still don't like her character.
I think she's like in over her head on a lot of things, and she's playing with fire, and she really got burned, obviously, here. But it wasn't going to be much better with Jeff, and she's already been put in place by her own father, who's so obsessed with social positions. Like, so she's like kind of being, you know, molded from all of these masculine egos and all these different directions. But
that's an interesting take. I just think she won't shut the fuck up. She talks way too much. And I think she doesn't really, I don't think she really understands how the world works.
Well, and that's, you know, kind of an important lesson in the 80s, is like the power of money and business and how you can very much get swallowed up into these things. And if you don't know what you're doing, you know, you might turn out like her character in some ways. And it's not like it's her fault, but the 80s world was a very vicious place. I mean, in some ways, we still carry a lot of those, you know, those priorities, but it wasn't the warm, fuzzy mid-20th century anymore.
Now, let's talk about Miss Crystal Carrington, or Mrs. Crystal Carrington. I get confused because Mark Jennings is always around.
Mark Jennings is just a mustache and some short shorts to me, so after that, I'm not really sure what the character's doing.
Oh, come on. He's got a big heart. He got her locket out of pawn or out of hawk.
He's another one. He's like, you know, on the surface, looking to be your ally and looking to take care of you, but really he just wants his own selfish. He's just trying to get...
No, I don't agree with that at all. He wanted to protect her. He still has feelings for her. And, you know... him displaying
well,
that
actually after... maybe in some ways that's more Crystal's fault then, because maybe she's not reading that.
Blame the woman.
He's putting that on the table, but she's not like picking it up because she's still trying to have this both ways where he's like her friend, but he's also his like
the, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think where she fucked
but I don't
up,
think he's gonna do that. He's like, I want Crystal back, like not
oh,
as
yeah,
a friend.
Yeah. No, right? I obviously that's where this is going.
It's nice to see you wearing the locket again. At least something of our past still matters to you. Picture of me inside. It's not still there.
I replaced it.
But I think where she messed up is that she's wearing this locket with every outfit now. And Blake, you know.
The necklace.
Like,
and another piece of jewelry that gets her into trouble.
Well, you know, this is the most interesting thing about Crystal is her jewelry collection. but no, I mean, it's a bad move. You know, she is honest with Blake and explains where it came from and all of that. But then literally the next like three times he sees her, she's wearing it. And I think it's, you know, got bad juju.
Well, this is another like I normally Crystal just kind of. Sometimes irritates me, but I'm never loving Crystal. In this moment, I just feel really bad for her because it's like she's just doing what Crystal does, which is she has this little memento and she's just so simplistic, not in a bad way, but you know, this to her is just, it's just my locket from back in the day and it doesn't have anything to do with Mark or me still having feelings for him. But of course, Blake's going to read it as such. Because this is what Blake does. I mean, this is, again, like, it's interesting how soap operas present you character types or they create characters that become their own type. And you have to understand the dynamic between these characters. So for Crystal, the locket is just a locket.
A family heirloom.
It's a sentimental item, right? Mm-hmm. But for Blake, it's, oh, you're cheating on me again because he thinks she's always cheating on him with somebody. So, you know, and then hijinks ensue, I'm sure. But we get the closing credits. So I guess we'll find out.
The best part of all of this locket stuff is that we got to see the fireplace roaring at La Mirage in that scene.
You mean with like the arched brickwork?
Mm-hmm.
It's still like full 1978 Mexican restaurant up in there. And I'm sure it's still a hot place for singles to mingle.
But, you know, it's not like Blake is totally preoccupied with this locket because he's, you know, still searching for Steven and has hired a preeminent psychic to find him because that's how desperate he is at this point.
So I like to call this period in the trajectory of like public interest in psychicism and the supernatural sort of like the post hippie era. It's sort of where the like the people who were into spiritualism and psychicism got about 10 or 20 years older, because it's not like the late 60s anymore, it's now 1982. So like they have like mansions in Malibu on the, you know, rocky beach, and it's all like modern decor. But yet it's still this like idea of like he's in touch with the supernatural and he's psychic. It's almost culty in a way, but I can't really describe it, like, you know, like Robert Monroe or like Scientology. All this, like, you know, the West Coast always associated with, like, the kooky psychotic.
Oh, yeah. No, of course they go straight to Malibu to find the world's
preeminent
psychic.
Malibu's where you
find
your preeminent psychics, right?
But now it didn't really make sense to me because Alexis is, like, a psychic. It's like, what about Adriana you were just communing with in Rome last season? Because that lady, that tarot card reader, predicted Cecil Colby's death.
Yeah. Yeah, she did.
So why didn't they go to Adriana to find Stephen Carrington's body or him living? can't answer that one, can you?
Because they just needed a cheap excuse to go to Malibu for an afternoon.
Because they wanted to get Paul
Shinar.
I mean,
when you have a private jet, you know, like, you got to take advantage.
Now, you know, do you recognize who the psychic, what movie he's from?
No, I just recognize him.
He was in Scarface.
I don't know if that's what I remember him from, but...
He's another Dynasty actor who died of AIDS.
Oh.
In 1989. Unfortunately, gone way too soon. He voiced the evil rat Jenner in The Secret of Nim.
The Secret of Nim. Which also came out in November, December of 1982.
Yeah, he was a really busy boy in the early 80s.
In the early 80s, yeah.
Yeah, but I think he does a good job here. He brings this weird gravitas, but also kind of snake oil salesman, because it seems like he's just trying to get a free trip to Denver.
Yeah, he's not the kind of psychic that's, you know, walking around in a gypsy peasant dress.
Yeah, yeah.
He's, with a wild hairdo. He's in a suit with a turtleneck, you know, like he's that kind of psychic.
Yeah, you got to know somebody to go find him.
Like, he might be on the Phil Donahue show tomorrow afternoon.
Well, I kind of feel like that's the vibe that I was getting, is that he was sort of this Hollywood psychic who'd been in the news and on Donahue and Hard Copy or whatever.
Hard Copy.
But I just don't know what to believe with this psychic, if he's really going to be able to find Steven, or if he's bamboozling the Carringtons.
I love that they were having that conversation in his living room. And, well, there's a couple things I love. First one is just Crystal giving the suspicious eyes to everybody.
Yeah, Linda Evans.
Crystal's not there for this. She's not having any of this.
She does do a good job of playing skeptic.
Linda Evans is doing some more of her eye acting that she's famous for. But also number two is like the psychic basically fishing for a free trip to Denver on the Carrington dime, you know? So it's like he sees Blake in a position of weakness. So he's like, yeah, I'm going to get a free trip to Denver out of
this.
The
letter's not stronger. Yeah, I need
more than just this letter.
And I need to be on the private jet.
Whole house that he used to live in. Yeah.
It's going to mess with my senses. Also, going to need a bottle of Dom Perignon. That really helps me tune in.
Because that's what I'm feeling was Steven's favorite champagne.
52, I think, is probably the year that's going to help me find him the best. And also a hooker.
If your son is alive, Mr. Carrington, he'll come to me here.
He will. I know he will.
But yeah, so I thought the episode would end with like the psychic, his eyes widening and saying, I see him, I see Steven. But it fucking ends back at the paint store with Dum Dum Adam.
Meanwhile, back at the old lumber yard, Lumbertown,
yeah.
Whatever.
That's where I get all of my poison paint, Lumbertown.
I'm curious to know, like, can you get poison paint mixed in whatever shade, or was it only made in certain colors?
Well, he said he was mixing it. So I think he was just getting the, like, poison lacquer at Lumbertown, and then he was going to Sherwin-Williams for the teal color.
Right. Because you got to, like, figure
out... Wait, why do you want to know about this? Because you're painting our office right now.
Yeah, but it ain't going to be teal, so you have nothing to worry about.
Oh, good. This is the part of the episode where Kyler and I reveal our looks of the week. There were a lot of outfits this episode, a lot of one scene ensembles.
And not a single one was good.
The
more reasons why this episode's just kind of off.
The biggest offender, I think, was Alexis was finally in her safari gear, which is, I think, what we were looking forward to with this jaunt to Southeast Asia.
Oh, she was full on Panama Jack with those knee-high socks and like head-to-toe khaki.
Yeah, and the collar popped, you know?
No, it wasn't working for me.
It wasn't, yeah. I wanted it to be
I mean, we do get one of her signature, like, short side, high updo hairstyles. So, you know, that's interesting. But
I wanted her to, like, take it to the next level. Like a Phyllis Neffler in Troop Beverly Hills. Like what she did.
That's just total costume at that point.
What do you think Alexis wears every goddamn episode? It's costume.
Well, this is definitely not costume. This is just, like, something you pick up at JCPenney's.
Yeah, so it was definitely wah-wah, totally underwhelming when I saw her in that outfit. I wanted to be more. Honestly, you know, you want to know who had my look of the week?
Linda Evans.
No,
really?
Kirby.
Oh, really? No, you got to explain that one.
Okay, so it's only a one-scener, but it's where she goes to talk to Fallon.
Oh, you nursery. Like the black and red thing.
She's got this black okay. and red. Now,
yeah, that would be a close runner-up.
Well,
yeah.
Here, let me defend my honor. So a lot of times on this show, more so in the first and second season, they do these kind of monochromatic looks where it's like all the same color or all, you know, two colors throughout. And it doesn't always kind of work because the mustard isn't mustardy enough mm-hmm. or the rose isn't like rosy enough.
Three shades of the same color.
But this is great because it's black and red, which, you know, I love black and red. That is a delicious combination. Well,
and black and red is like fully embracing, like, this ain't the 70s anymore. Like, this is very of that time.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. The suede knee-high boots are the same color. They match with the red detail on the top. And the cherry on top, or should I say the cherry on the ponytail, is she's got a little red...
I just used to call those deedly balls. I don't know what those are.
Yeah, whatever. At the end of her long ass braided hair, she's got a little red.
Not a little red Corvette.
What do you call those?
Little red riding
that you put in your
beret.
Little red beret.
Little red beret. I don't know. Why does that song keep coming up? And in specifically reference to her, there's something about her that just red is her thing.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that was my look of the week. Crystal was disqualified for me because she wore the same jewelry with every outfit this episode. So sorry.
Wait, are you classifying the locket as the same jewelry?
I am.
Okay. Well, whatever. The locket's kind of lame, but you know, whatever. She does wear that nice white, you know, column gown that... same silhouette she always has, but it has like the nice hand.
The fabric on that was really nice.
Yeah, it almost had like a sort of like.
Is this your look of the week?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it had almost like an astrological or zodiac quality to the whatever the pattern was.
Oh, we're talking about something different. I'm talking about the silvery dress, the shiny dress was wearing.
Not
with
the
Jeff.
Cheap polyester satin thing. No, not that.
I hated that.
Oh, you hated that.
Yeah, okay. It was ugly. Well, do you want to talk any more about it, or are you...
No, because, again, this is feeding back into why this episode's just kind of a, you know, flat tire. Like,
I mean, she looked
there's a lot of forced writing. There's no great performances here, although the psychic is sort of a fun performance. And then none of the clothes are even that interesting. So it's all the, like... If you don't have any of those things, you don't have an episode of Dynasty.
I think subtext...
I mean, I guess you got some jet setting. I guess there was that, but...
Yeah, I do love that. But I do think there's a little bit of subtext with Crystal, because did you notice that she was drinking sherry in the library, mm-hmm. and then she went to go meet Mark and had a whole big glass of wine? So I think maybe she's got an alcohol issue.
Well, you know, it's classic Queen of Cups characteristics, like... alcoholism. Yeah,
well, you got to fill all them cups up.
Yep.
Well, Kyler, thank you so much for joining me for another episode of Dynasty as They Want to Be. It's good to be back.
I think we're gonna go supreme with the donuts.
Oh no, you didn't.
Oh yes, I did.
All right, well, that's it, guys. Thank you for listening. Go follow us on social media if you're not already. We're at Nasty Podcast. That's NASTY Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, everywhere. Like, and most importantly, go nominate us for a podcast award in the TV and film category at podcastawards.com. We'll see you next week when we talk about the episode Samantha. Who could that be about? Bye, y'all.
Ta-ta for now.